like to say, David.
Okay, thank you, Rob. Before I hand over to Stephen, I will just make one opening comment about the book of Job, which lots of people can't quite fit in to the Bible. It's not easy to work out where it's come from, who it's about, and all the rest of it. Stephen will be opening that up to us, but I really hope I don't steal his thunder when I say that when I started studying it in preparation for this talk, I really felt it was almost as though it was the answer to an unasked question, which is, but Rabbi, what happens if everyone's keeping all the laws we've heard about in the Torah and their life falls apart anyway? I really hope I haven't stolen Stephen's thunder there, but Stephen, over to you.
Thank you, David. And that is the question, isn't it, really? That's what the book of Job really is all about. can I just congratulate you for coming? To be honest, if I wasn't doing the talk, I don't think I'd be here. So credit to you for that. We do various evening services at Green Street, and we don't do them every week at all, but I did a series a few years ago now on the book of Job. I did seven talks on Job, so you are getting a condensed version of that. So anybody with a memory who was here from Green Street might recognize some of this, and some of it is literally written, lifted from notes I did at the time. We'll come back to that in a few moments. David's absolutely right on several fronts. The book of Job is 42 chapters long. And if you were writing what the book of Job is about, you could probably do it in about 2 chapters. So there's an awful lot in there. There's huge chunks of dialogue that go on. And trying to follow the drift of the argument is not at all easy. It's quite tortuous. David's word, tedious, absolutely right. And the last time I was here, I think I was talking about the minor prophets, and I said I like the minor prophets because they're so short. That cannot be said of Job. That makes it actually quite a difficult book to access. But why it's worth persevering with is simply because, as David indicated, it touches on, I would say, the fundamental question that religious faith has always asked. And that is, why do the righteous suffer? It doesn't matter what faith tradition you are from, but that is a question that will be asked at some point when you are encountering people who are struggling with health or things go wrong in their lives. The things that Job teases out are questions that people will always ask, have always asked, and will always ask. So if you've got Bibles there, you might want to open them because we're going to dip into Job at 2 or 3 different places, but there's no better way of starting than starting at the beginning. So I'm just going to read from Job chapter 1 and the first 5 verses. And if someone's got a page number from the Pew Bibles, that might... What's 509, if you're following it in the... well, they're not pews, are they? The chair Bibles. Job 1, 1 to 5. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. His sons used to hold feasts in their homes on their birthdays, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. This was Job's regular custom. Let me address one issue to begin with, which we don't have to have an opinion on, but I just raise it, and if you want to come back at the end, that's fine. It's not a mega thing, but it's just worth thinking through. And it's to do with the historicity of this man Job. Was there a man who walked this earth whose name was Job? Or is this more of a parable? I'm going to argue that it doesn't matter one way or the other, because I think the principles that drawn out of this book are the same anyway. So whether there was a physical human chap called Job and all these things happened to him, or whether this is a Good Samaritan sort of thing, a parable, it doesn't matter. To me, there are one or two indications that it has a bit of a parable feel to it. I always think the land of Utz sounds a bit like the land of Oz, but that's me. I'm always suspicious of these rather convenient numbers. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels, the 7 and the 3 and the 7 and the 3. And that phrase, he was the greatest man among all the people of the East, that again has this smack of parable about it. But as I say, I don't think it matters which side of that fence we come down on. At the end of the day, what matters are the principles that are drawn out, and they're the same whether that this man walked the earth or whether the writer has created a very skillful, imaginative parable for us. We've also got, and in a sense, this kind of goes to underline what I'm saying about the parable nature of the thing. We have these dreadful things that happen to him. And on the basis of probability, he was very unlucky. So chapter 1, verse 14, the chap comes running to him. The oxen were ploughing, the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabaeans attacked and made off with them all. And they put the servants to the sword, and I'm the only one left. Verse 16... another messenger comes. The fire of God fell from heaven and burnt up the sheep and the servants, and I'm the only one left. Verse 17. The Chaldeans formed 3 raiding parties and swept down on your camels and made off with them, and they put the servants to the sword, and I'm the only one left. And then worst of all, verse 18. The messenger comes and says, your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert, struck the 4 corners of the house. It collapsed on them, and they are dead, and I'm the only one left to tell the tale. For all that to happen on the same day to one man is, you draw your own conclusions. And then, of course, we have chapter 2, and chapter 2 tells us that Job was afflicted with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the crown of his head, we find him taking a piece of broken pottery and scraping himself with it as he sat among the ashes. So Job has all these terrible things that happen to him, to his family, to his whatever, and then all these terrible things that happen to him personally. But the thing you have to remember, the thing that's really, really important, is that opening verse 1. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. That is the verdict of the writer of the book of Job. It's God's verdict on him, and it never ever wavers. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. Job was exactly that. There was no flaw in his moral character. There was no flaw in his spirituality. He was blameless and upright. he feared God and he shunned evil. That verdict of God on Job never changes, never varies from start to finish. And Job's response to all these things that happened to him are equally commendable. Verse 22 of chapter 1. In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. And you get the similar verdict in chapter 2 as well, when all these things happened to him as well. So Job's moral and spiritual standing in God's presence was impeccable. Impeccable, and we told that from the beginning, and it's underlined for us at several points in the opening of the book and then again reaffirmed at the end of the book. So that's the beginning, that's the opening, that's what we're told. The terrible things that happened to him, but he was blameless and upright, he feared God and he shunned evil. Now the bulk of the book is made up of a dialogue between Job and his three friends, sometimes known as Job's comforters. The three friends are introduced to us in chapter 2, verse 11, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And the best thing they ever did, the best thing the three friends ever did, was given to us in verse 13 of chapter 2. Then they sat on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights. No one said a word to him because they saw how great his suffering was. They sat in total silence with him. They sat in solidarity with him and they didn't open their mouths. And the only time they got into trouble was when they opened their mouths. And that, sadly, is often the case today as well. Because we get into trouble when we try and explain God so often. When we try and justify what is happening. We get ourselves into such a tangle sometimes by trying to attribute things to God when actually we shouldn't be attributing things to God. And the three friends are a classic example of what to do and what not to do. And trying to theologize into someone's misery and suffering is the worst possible thing you can try and do. Sitting in total silence and solidarity with them ain't a bad thing at all. To sum up what the three friends are trying to say, and as I say, it's a very long portion. In fact, it's the bulk of the book, really. Job saying this and one of the friends saying that. Job saying this, one of the other friends saying that. The bulk of what they're trying to say is that, Job, you must have done something wrong. If you were to water it down, if you were to condense it to its simplest thing, what the three friends are collectively saying, Job, God is punishing you for something you have done. They follow a logic that comes in part from the book of Deuteronomy. And the book of Deuteronomy has a very simple logic to it. The book of Deuteronomy basically says, if you are good, then everything will go well. And if you are bad, then you'll suffer. That's the simplistic analysis of what the book of Deuteronomy is saying. And the three friends all come from the school of Deuteronomy. They all come from the same shed, basically. And one by one, in slightly different way, shapes or form, they're turning to Job and says, Job, you must have done something to deserve this. You must have done something wrong. They say to him, look deep into your soul. You must have offended God somehow. You need to repent. And if you repent, you'll be restored. That's what the three friends are saying. Now, there's a fourth character who pops up in chapter 32. This is Elihu. In some ways, he doesn't add a great deal to the debate. He's a variation on a theme. But if the first three friends are basically saying, God is punishing you, Job, then Elihu's slight variation is to say, God is trying to reform you, Job. Elihu takes the line that life is a moral trial and that God is teaching you a lesson. Life is some form of spiritual gymnasium. This is the view of the three friends. God is punishing you. Elihu, God is reforming you. That's what they're saying. And in saying that, these three friends, four friends, if we want to include the other one as well, they are basically picking up a view and an idea that has been run with by people of faith ever since the beginning of time. In the Jewish world, in the Christian world, in other world religions as well, there will be many, many, many who will say, if you are suffering, if something is going wrong in your life, you must have done something to deserve it. That is a line that has been said from time immemorial, and that is a line that is still parroted out today as well. You will often hear it said. David Watson, who was curate here in the 1960s and who went on to become vicar at St. Michael the Belfry in York in the 1970s and 80s, had a superb ministry, hugely successful. His national speaking, his role as an evangelist, hugely successful. His building up of St. Michael the Belfry in York was tremendous. He developed cancer, and out of his experience of suffering from cancer, he wrote a book called Fear No Evil. And he tells us in this book that after his diagnosis of cancer, he received letters from Christians who said, "This is happening because of your pride. This is happening because of your unbelief. This is happening because of your secret sins." And they urged him to repent and confess his sins. Now, that was in the 1980s. Where are we? What's changed? Nothing. That's what Job's comforters were saying. That's what Job's friends were saying. You must have done something wrong. So what I'm saying is that this is nothing new at all. What these friends are saying here is something that is still being espoused now, today, in our day and age. David Watson, he makes a very good point. He takes up this idea from Elihu that maybe God's teaching him a lesson. And David Watson says, "Well, it's a pretty rum lesson, isn't it, when the patient dies? How can I learn from it if at the end of the day I've popped my clogs?" Which is what happened to him, he died. A pretty stiff lesson if there isn't any time left to learn from it. Once you start to think through the logic of that line of thinking that those people who wrote to David Watson were saying, once you start through thinking through the logic of what the three friends are saying here, then you start to realise how silly it really is. Because if you start to think about all the suffering in the world and the scale of all the suffering in the world, if you are trying to say, because it's not just about me, it's not just about you, it's not just about Auntie Nellie or whoever it is, the conclusions that we come to here have to be suitable for everybody in the whole world. The lessons that we derive from here have to be applicable to everybody. Are we therefore saying that everybody who falls down and breaks their knee has somehow offended God? Are we saying that somehow everybody who contracts cancer has somehow sinned against the Almighty? Are we saying that somehow everybody who is hit by a car and whatever has somehow offended the Almighty? Are we saying that? Are we really saying that? Are we saying that every instance of suffering in this world is somehow God trying to teach us a lesson or God punishing us for something? When you say it like that, you realise how daft it is, how potty it is. But do you know what? We still insist on saying it. And if we don't say it, we think it. I can guarantee that if you go home tonight, and as you're sitting there watching Endeavour on the television, with your cup of tea and your hot cross bun, as I hope to be, and the phone goes, and somebody says, so-and-so in church has contracted beriberi, something. There will be that little something in your head, something in your head that says, oh dear, whatever have they done to deserve that? Guarantee that you'll think that. Or worse, well, it's not worse, but anyway, you wake up Monday morning and you suddenly look at yourself and you think, oh no, I've got beriberi. And what do you say to yourself? What have I done to deserve this, Lord? That's the logic of the friends. It's still there in our heads. We can't get rid of it. It will not go away, this idea that somehow we must have done something wrong. Somehow we must have offended the Almighty. Somehow there's a reason for this. We always want to find a reason for something. Honestly, if God was like that, he wouldn't be good. He'd be a monster. If God sat there deliberately planning his day by saying, whose legs can I break today? Whose arms can I, whose hips can I dislocate today? What sort of a God would we have if that's what he did? There seems to be an instinct among people of faith to operate on this simplistic reward and punishment system. And we don't seem to be able to shake it off, even today. And what the writer of the book of Job is trying to do, he's trying to challenge that. I don't know when this book was written. It was obviously written hundreds of years before Jesus. But I tell you what, the man who wrote this book was a theological genius. He had insight that was far beyond his age and his society. He was seeing things far deeper than many of his contemporaries. We class the book of Job as part of the wisdom literature. And rightly so, because it's very wise. He wants to challenge simple and simplistic ideas about God that were peddled around then and are still peddled around now. The whole purpose, the whole point of the book of Job is to undermine the stupidity of what the three friends are trying to say. He wants to distance himself from the logic of the three friends. And at the end of the book, when you get to chapter 42, God turns round and he says to Job, well done, mate. Good on you, lad. And he turns round to the three friends and he says, you're a load of idiots, to coin a phrase. He reaffirms his verdict of Job and he tells the three friends, you're talking off the top of your heads. You do not know what you're talking about. That's what the book of Job is about. It's to rubbish this idea that people suffer for a reason. That's what he's trying to knock on the head. He's trying to bang it out. But do you know, it's so stubborn, it won't go. And it still stays here. We still think these daft thoughts, even though the writer of the book of Job wanted us to get rid of it a long, long time ago. In fact, let me, I've written it down here, let me read that last bit from Job 42. Where is it? Job 42, 7-9. After the Lord had said these things to Job, he said to Eliphaz the Temanite, I am angry with you and your two friends, because you have not spoken the truth about me as my servant Job has. Listen to that phrase, my servant Job. You cannot get a more wonderful affirmation than this. Because you have not spoken the truth about me as my servant Job has. So now take 7 bulls and 7 rams and go to my servant Job and sacrifice a burnt offering for yourselves. My servant Job will pray for you and I will accept his prayer and not deal with you according to your folly. That's what he says about them. You have not spoken the truth about me as my servant Job has. So Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, Zophar the Naamathite did what the Lord told them. And the Lord accepted Job's prayer. There is no cause and effect. That's what you have to understand. Here is a man called Job, who was blameless and upright and feared God and shunned evil. The greatest man in the East, if you want to call him that. That's him on the one hand. And on the other hand, there is this man, Job, who is a sufferer, who dreadful things happen to his family. He loses his job. He loses his income. He loses his health. Some of the later books about Job, that were written, said that he suffered. Sometimes they said he suffered for 7 years. Some of them said he suffered 20 years. We don't know. Terrible suffering. I mean, it's legendary, isn't it? The suffering of Job. Absolutely dreadful things happened to him. But the verdict is still the same. He was blameless and upright, feared God and shunned evil. The two are said, but they sit side by side and they are not connected in any way, shape or form. The three friends want to connect it. They want to put cause to effect. If the suffering, he must have done something wrong. And the purpose of the writer of the book of Job is to say, no, there is no connection. There is no link. You have to understand that there is no causal link between suffering and the things that happen. He's blameless, upright, God-fearing, and all these things happen. They happen, but they are not caused, they're not connected. That's the important thing that we have to grasp there. Over the years, I've done some work on C.S. Lewis's writings. And one of C.S. Lewis's most famous books, theological books, was called The Problem of Pain. And it was published in 1940, but I suspect it was written probably the year before that. And C.S. Lewis effectively adopts a position that's very similar to the three friends. It's very much out of the Deuteronomic school of thinking. This is him writing 1939-1940, and C.S. Lewis says, pain is the vehicle which God uses to wake us from our complacency and bring us back to himself. Sounds like Elihu. C.S. Lewis says, God whispers to us in our pleasures. He speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pain. It is his megaphone to raise a deaf world. Now, he writes that in 1939. I do not think that he could have written that in 1946, because I do not see how he could have written all of that after the horrors of the Second World War and after the horrors of the Holocaust. I do not think he could have honestly have said, pain is God's megaphone to raise a deaf world, when 6 million Jews had been exterminated through the concentration camps of Central and Eastern Europe. And when you look again, as we have done recently, at some of those horrendous photographs and films of those starving, malnourished, disease-ridden skeletons that are walking around in Belsen and wherever it was, Auschwitz, to even give the hint, you must have done something to deserve it. Even to give the hint of a suggestion of that is monstrous. I don't think Lewis could have written that in 1946 as he wrote it in 1939. Now, in 1961, he wrote another book, and it was called A Grief Observed. And late in life, he'd married Joy Gresham, and they were absolutely ecstatic. He never thought he would find the wholeness and the completeness that he'd found in Joy Gresham. And even, I think, before they were married, she was diagnosed with cancer, and he nursed her, and he sat by her side. And he writes this book, A Grief Observed. I think he started it. Did he start it before she died, or was it just after? I cannot remember now. But he says, why? Why did you give me so much pleasure only to snatch it away from me again? And he says, God is the cosmic sadist. He is the eternal vivisector. That's the phrase he uses. And if somebody had gone to C.S. Lewis and says, well, pain is God's megaphone to raise a deaf world, he'd have hit them. You see theological shift in Lewis's writings when he became a sufferer himself. Instead of being a theoretical theologian giving the right answers and the sound answers from the textbooks, he suddenly feels and understands suffering like he's never understood it before. And he says to his old self, don't talk such tosh. And it's not just me saying this. Do you know what? There's a guy in the New Testament, and he points us in the same direction as well. And this guy is you might have heard of him, he's called Jesus. And go away and read the beginning of John chapter 9 if you want. There's a story of a man born blind. And the disciples say, well, who sinned first? Him or his parents? And Jesus says, oh my days, what are you talking about? Neither this man nor his parents, blah, blah, blah. My favourite is Luke 13, verses 1 to 5. Jesus says this. Now there were some present at that time who told Jesus about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. Now look, in the Jewish world there is nothing more sacred than blood. There is nothing more important than the integrity of blood. And for Jewish blood to be mixed with the Gentile sacrifices was about the worst possible fate that could have befallen anybody. And you could have imagined that there were all the wags round the synagogue who were saying, these, they must have done something terribly wrong for this to have happened to them. There were some present at that time who told Jesus about the Galileans, the Jews, whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. And Jesus answered, do you think that these Galileans were worse sinners than all the other Galileans because they suffered this way? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you too will all perish. Or those 18 who died when the tower in Siloam fell on them. Now you can imagine that, can't you? There's this great big tower and it tumbles down and there's 18 killed. And the wags in the synagogue that have all said, oh dear, they must have done something wrong there. Those 18 who died when the tower in Siloam fell on them, do you think they were more guilty than all the others living in Jerusalem? And what does Jesus say? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you too will all perish. Jesus breaks that attempt to put a causal link between suffering and the reasoning for that suffering. Jesus says there was no reason why that man was born blind. There was no reason why those 18 had that tower fall on them. They hadn't done anything wrong. They hadn't done anything to deserve it. And yet people of faith at the time were trying to connect the two. They were trying to bring them together. They were trying to say, well, if this dreadful thing happened to them, then they must have deserved it somehow. They must have done something wrong. They're echoing the views of the friends again. And Jesus says, no, not so. And he breaks the tie, he breaks the link, he breaks the connection, just as the writer of Job was trying to break the connection. The writer to the book of Job doesn't solve the problem of suffering, he doesn't attempt to solve the problem of suffering. But what he wanted to do, the one thing that he wanted to do, he successfully did. And that was he challenged this causal link between suffering and whatever. Reward and punishment, whatever. He breaks that link. And the insight, the skill that he shows in doing that is so, so important. If only we would learn that lesson today. But we still don't learn that lesson. And we'll still go home tonight and when so-and-so's been diagnosed with beriberi, we'll say, oh, dear, dear, dear. But if we'd only learn the lessons from the writer of Job and if we've only learned the lesson of Jesus, then we would finish up with a much healthier view of God. Because sometimes the views of God that we espouse make him out to be a monster. And I don't think the world out there is very impressed with some of our attempts to theologize. I don't think the world out there is at all impressed when we try and attribute cause to things that have no cause, to suffering, to try and find reasons and explanations for suffering. The most helpful book, I've probably in my life read 3 or 4 books that have been absolutely transformative for me in my thinking. And I have to tell you that one of them was a book by Harold Kushner, Rabbi Harold Kushner. And he wrote it back in the 70s or 80s, and it was called Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. That's the theme of Job, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. Kushner was an Orthodox rabbi, came from an Orthodox school of thinking. And his understanding of God was totally transformed when his son was born with a condition called progeria, which is commonly called rapid aging. So that basically you grow by, facially, you grow by 8 or 9 years every year. By the time he was 7 or 8, this boy was an old man, and his facial features were all those of an old man. And he died, I don't know how old he was when he died. So here is this Orthodox Jew who's been brought up on the scriptures, who's been brought up on the good school of Deuteronomy, who'd been taught, like C.S. Lewis had been taught, who'd been taught that if bad things happen, well, there has to be a reason for it. And he's looking at this boy in front of him, and he's saying, what's he done wrong? This boy's done nothing wrong. And so he has to rethink his understanding of who God is. And he writes this beautiful book. It's the most wonderful book, I can ever remember. Most books, you read them and you forget them. But why bad things happen to good people? Harold Kushner. And the thing that stands out for me in that book, he tries to make the point that sometimes things happen for no reason. And an illustration he gives in the book is about Martin Luther King and the assassination of Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King murdered, and people of faith were saying, why? What did he do? He must have done something to deserve that fate. And Kushner turns it around, and he says, why can't we acknowledge that the assassination was an affront to God, even as it was to us, and a sidetracking of his purposes? Rather than straining our imaginations to find evidence of God's fingerprints on the murder weapon, why can't we acknowledge that the assassination was an affront to God, even as it was to us, a sidetracking of his purposes, rather than straining our imaginations to find evidence of God's fingerprints on the murder weapon? Because that's what people were trying to do. They were trying to deduce, what had he done wrong to deserve this? He must have done something wrong to deserve this. And the answer came back from Harold Kushner, from Jesus, from the writer of Job. No, it wasn't that God was doing something for a reason. It wasn't that God was teaching him a lesson. It wasn't that God was punishing him. To think like that is to think like a pagan. It's to think like primitive cavemen again, who saw the volcanoes going off and bowed down to the volcano thinking, we've offended the deity somehow. Let's go and sacrifice our daughters because that might appease the god of the volcano. We're just the same. It's the same mindset. Let me also introduce you to another helpful, so helpful, idea that the writer of the Job gives us. And it follows on, it helps move us on where we're going in our thinking. As I say, the bulk of the book is a dialogue between Job and his friends, and then Elihu. And then towards the end of the book, chapters 38, 39, 40 and 41, if you read nothing else for your homework, children, go home and read Job 38, 39, 40 and 41. And I will test you on this next week. No, I won't, because I won't be here next week. you won't read it, I'm sure you won't, so I'm going to read a bit of it for you. In fact, I'm going to read the whole of chapter 39. It's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. Chapter 38 is brilliant, but listen to 39, because there's a reason why I'm reading this particular chapter. Here we go. This is God speaking to Job. Do you know when the mountain goats gave birth? Do you watch when the doe bears her fawn? Do you count the mouths, the months till they bear? Do you know the time they give birth? They crouch down and bring forth their young. Their labor pains are ended. Their young thrive and grow strong in the wilds. They leave and do not return. Who let the wild donkey go free? Who untied his ropes? I gave it the wasteland as its home, the salt flats as its habitat. It laughs at the commotion in the town. It does not hear a driver's shout. It ranges the hills for its pasture and searches for any green thing. Will the wild ox consent to serve you? Will it stay by your manger at night? Can you hold it to the furrow with a harness? Will it till the valley behind you? Will you rely on it for its great strength? Will you leave your heavy work to it? Can you trust it to haul in your grain and bring it to your threshing floor? The wings of the ostrich flap joyfully, though they cannot compare with the wings and feathers of the stork. She lays her eggs on the ground and lets them warm in the sand, unmindful that a foot may crush them, that some wild animal may trample them. She treats her young harshly as if they were not hers. She cares not that her labor was in vain, for God did not endow her with wisdom or give her a share of good sense. Yet when she spreads her feathers to run, she laughs at horse and rider. Do you give the horse its strength or clothe its neck with a flowing mane? Do you make it leap like a locust, striking terror with its proud snorting? It paws fiercely, rejoicing in its strength, and charges into the fray. It laughs at fear, afraid of nothing. It doesn't shy away from the sword. The quiver rattles against its side, along the flashing spear and lance. In frenzied excitement, it eats up the ground. It cannot stand still when the trumpet sounds. At the blast of the trumpet, it snorts, "Aha!" It catches the scent of battle from afar, the shout of commanders and the battle cry. Does the hawk take flight by your wisdom and spread its wings towards the south? Does the eagle soar at your command and build its nest on high? It dwells on a cliff and stays there at night. A rocky crag is its stronghold. From there it looks for food. Its eyes detect it from afar. Its young ones feast on blood. And where the slain are, there it is. What he's describing there in chapter 39 is a world that is free and autonomous and spontaneous, that is wild. That's the key word in that chapter. Wild, the wild goat, the wild donkey, the wild ox. Can you tame them? No, of course not. It describes the antics of the ostrich and the stork and these animals going behind rocks and doing things. And it's the vastness, it's the expanse of all this created thing. And there's freedom there. God isn't pulling the strings. God isn't saying to the ox, go and do this. God isn't saying to the stork, go and do that. He isn't saying to the mountain goats, do that. He isn't doing that. They're just doing it. There's a freedom in the world. There's a freedom in the animal kingdom, he's saying. Things just happen. You cannot control it. He makes it abundantly clear. And in chapters 40 and 41, he goes on and he talks about these two. I don't know whether they're animals or whether they're chaos monsters or whatever they are. Behemoth and Leviathan. David, if you're looking for a theme later in the year, get somebody, but don't get me, to talk about Behemoth and Leviathan. Who are they in the scriptures? It's amazing. But they're wild. They're uncontrollable. You can't tie them down. You can't domesticate them. That's what the writer's saying. He's describing a world that has its own internal freedom, that cannot be tamed, that cannot be tied down, that cannot be controlled. And in giving us this description of the world, he's saying to us, isn't this the world in which we live? A world in which things happen. Random, spontaneous things happen. And although as men and women of faith, we're always looking for reason. We're always looking for reason. We're always trying to attribute cause and effect. We're always trying to do that. And the writer of Job is saying, no, stop trying to do that. Recognize that things happen. And sometimes it's just part of this free, autonomous world that God has made. And there isn't always a reason. There isn't always a reason. But sometimes things just happen. The writer of the book of Job, as I say, he doesn't solve the problem of suffering. Nobody's ever solved the problem of suffering. But what he does so helpfully is point us in some directions. And he tries to get us thinking in new ways. He tries us to understand that this world isn't, you can't fit it into a neat box. You can't fit it into a neat solution. We want to do that so much. We want to be able to give simple answers. And yet the world is full of complexity. And our simple and simplistic answers just will not work so often. We cannot domesticate God and we cannot domesticate the problems in this world. We cannot try and attribute everything to God. Sometimes there is freedom and things just happen. Job is trying to tell us that. Helpfully so. And although he doesn't solve the problem of suffering, he does at least point us in a direction of travel where we can start to go. And he points us to a person called Jesus, who was to step into a world of suffering and was to become a recipient of suffering. And it's only when we look to Jesus that we find answers to the problem of suffering that were unknown to the writer of the book of Job. So if you look into this book for answers, then he doesn't solve the problem. But my word, doesn't he help us to get rid of some of the junk and the nonsense that goes on between our ears and helps us to start thinking in some new, helpful and creative ways. I'm sure I've run over my time, David, but there we are.